Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Science vs. Fiction, the podcast in which two friends discuss two movies that are too good, right?
That's how it works, right? Too bad in certain cases.
Too bad for you. Steven, how have you been lately?
I've been good. I've been good.
Good. Me too, relatively speaking. Since we try to do these in a timeless fashion with no topical references whatsoever, it's kind of hard to make small talk.
Yeah.
But I hope everybody out there is good and healthy and happy right now. We are recording this in early April of 2021. And we are here to discuss two bizarre, dystopian, dark satire, rambling metaphors that have inspired film geeks to argue about both the meaning and the relative quality. We have 1985's Brazil by Terry Gilliam. And Stephen, what is our second film?
Our second film is 2008. Is that right? 2008's Southland Tales by Richard Kelly.
Director of Donnie Darko, the film that I absolutely love. And I think that in an alternate universe or in the near future, possibly, Richard Kelly could transform himself once again and get out of director's jail.
I don't know that he can. It was 2006, by the way, not 2008.
What was the inspiration for us doing this episode, Stephen? We wanted to do something different. We've covered a lot of different kinds of sci-fi, and we wanted to discuss two controversial films that are on the fringes of science fiction, but have inspired just lots and lots of discussion.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's been a while since we made this matchup, so I don't recall the specific reasoning, but I believe it had mostly to do with the fact that I have very strong opinions about Southland Tales, and I have always wanted to share them and never had an outlet before, and so now I do because I have a podcast. So I said, all right, well, what can we pair with Southland Tales? And Brazil seemed very logical, a very logical pairing. The movies, if you just described the plots of them to people without any reference to who made them and the quality and whatnot, like they're very similar. But on the other hand, they could not be more different.
I have very strong feelings also about Brazil and its filmmaker. So the reason that Brazil holds a special place in my heart, even though I have in recent years come to not really appreciate the director, Terry Gilliam, all that much, but I can't lie when I say that films like Time Bandits, Brazil, Baron Munchausen, 12 Monkeys, Fisher King meant a lot to me when I first saw them and are very well-made films. That's just, regardless of what I may think of the filmmaker now, that's just a fact. Mm-hmm. And Brazil, for many years, was one of my very favorite movies for a lot of different reasons. And I think one of the most fascinating things about Brazil, which is takes place in an Orwellian near future, that is, what would you call it? Partially Orwell, partially Monty Python. Is that right?
Yeah. I actually one of the things in my notes, which I was going to get to later, but I may as well say now, one of the things that I caught this viewing, I think it was because the first time I've seen it since I've seen this other movie, but I caught a lot of Putney Swope influence.
Oh, man.
And I can't remember if there were any specific references, but there was a lot of it that I was just kind of like, huh,
that's a good bomb to drop on me unprepared. I like it. All right. So it's about a man trapped in a massive bureaucracy in the near future, which would probably look a lot like where we live now.
Sort of, except it's very much, well, I mean, it was made in the 1980s, so it's hard to tell how much of this is it's weird because there are so many movies now that have this retro future aesthetic that are like, oh, let's kind of make a movie that like looks like it was made in the 80s about the future. Mm-hmm. And you forget sometimes that like movies that were made in the 80s, that was just how they viewed the future.
And obviously I don't think you're making this comparison. I think Gilliam and his collaborators were a whole lot smarter than the guys who were doing like Mad Max ripoffs that were set at 2021, right?
Yeah.
You know, the date is not quite as important as the idea of this is where we're headed.
Right. But then again, there are a lot of little touches in the production design that that are clearly not meant to be predictive. So, for instance, a couple of the ones that, like, they had these sort of retro future televisions throughout a lot of it. The telephones, they have the telephones with the little mini switchboards in them where people can, like, connect and disconnect.
Yeah,
like,
that's all Gilliam. That is the idea that we're in the future, they say 50, 75 years in the future, but yet there are now antiquated things that are brought back into vogue, which is what happens. You know, yep. It's, you know, within the next 5 years, we, you know, could always see fashions from the 30s coming back into the
style. Right, but that's a specifically a technological thing. And, you know, it's not even so much like, okay, well, there's a fashion that's brought back, but it's like, you can't imagine a future where you would ever need a phone that has its own little switchboard where you actually unplug and plug little cables into. Like, even in the 80s, we were well beyond that technology. So there was clearly a deliberate choice to sort of be like, okay, well, this, it's not meant to be our future is what I'm saying. I think it's meant to be right. Sort of a different world, a different, like, it takes place in another universe in a sense.
It's also, I think it's a bit of, this takes place in our near future and I'm just ridiculing what, like, for example, we all have these little gadgets. Well, by me putting this arcane, ridiculous phone item into one of my character's hands, you know, I'm ridiculing the people who had, you know, back when he made this movie, he probably saw people carrying those giant woodblock cell phones around. Yep. And that's what he's mocking, that ridiculous technology, you know?
Yeah.
And I just think as a movie about how the individual can and often is swallowed up by the giant corporate or government or societal machine, I think it's a very interesting metaphor. I think it's a very visually fascinating plot-wise. You know, I think it does linger here and there. I think it does have moments where you're like, all right, you know, like, I do not think, and I'll get into this in a minute, but I do not like the super short version, which is terrible. But I also think that maybe his, Terry Gilliam's, preferred version is a bit indulgent in its own right.
Well, so run us through that real quick. Give us a little bit of the history of Brazil. And it's
basically,
and it's,
it was
versions.
That Universal, there was a final cut. Universal wanted to put out a super truncated version with a weird happy ending, or happier ending, I should say, and wanted to gut it. And film critics who had seen the film overseas, I believe at Cannes or Venice, or I don't remember off the top of my head, but Jack Matthews, I believe, and film critics from California, mostly LA, had seen it and were championing it. And they sent a letter to Universal basically saying, we have seen the director's version of this movie and it's freaking great. And if you're going to, like, force him to cut it down to 130 minutes or do it behind his back, we're going to write about that. That, don't do that. And it was, to me as a kid, I was, what, you know, 15, 16, 17 when I heard about all this, as a kid who both loved Terry Gilliam and also liked film critics, I was like, well, that's a good story. A filmmaker sticks to his guns. Some film critics who love the film defend it, and the right version comes out and, you know, bombs. It makes no money.
It wouldn't have, like, exactly. It wasn't.
You don't sign off on this script thinking you're getting Die Hard 2.
Right. I mean, like, that's the weird thing about that kind of meddling in these kinds of movies. It's like, yeah, you can sort of understand it with something like, say, Justice League, which just got, you know, its own deluxe version released, where, like, it's a movie that cost $300 million to make. It's got to make a, you know, it's got to make a pretty penny in order for the studio to make, you know, and then it's got merchandising and all this other stuff that depends on the movie doing well. And so you can see, like, in those cases, you know, or Fantastic Four, where, like, okay, well, we signed off on this script and it's weird and it's different and it's very idiosyncratic and personal vision for the filmmaker, but we are going to, you know, we're going to get cold feet at the last minute and we're going to do a bunch of reshoots to try to make it. It almost never works, right? Like, how many movies have done that and then the final result is better and or more successful?
It's a good question, but the simple answer is, when it's a success story, we rarely hear that, oh, there were hurried reshoots. We rare, you know what I mean?
I don't know that that's true nowadays, because nowadays, like, you know,
nowadays, yes, but I think you're talking about, like, you know, great movies of this era.
That may be really true. It's possible that in the past, but again, even by now, like, all of those stories would have come out, right? So, like, you would know those stories because whoever, you know, if it happened 20 years ago, somebody would have told that story by now. And if it happens today, it would have leaked to the press while the movie was being made. So I feel like we, you know, we have a pretty good idea of a lot of the, you know, behind the scenes shenanigans and studio interference in a lot of movies. But regardless, my point is it's just like, yeah, you're right. Like, why would you take it? Like, this feels like the kind of thing where you're just like, you know what? We don't get it. but we believe in you as a filmmaker. Go make the movie and good luck. And we'll do our best to market it to who we think will enjoy the kind of movie that you made, instead of what studios do, which is, okay, how can we make this movie a thing that we can market?
Yeah, yeah. And well, yeah. And it is kind of a, oh, you did Time Bandits and that was an unexpected hit for somebody else. Even though your script is weird and Orwellian and not family friendly and dark and strange and expensive, yeah, we're just going to give you the money anyway and hope we get Time Bandits out of it. You know, like right. That.
But then,
and that's just
yeah,
dumb.
You get what you get at that point. Yeah. And like, yeah, I don't know. I mean,
I'd much rather have they say, Terry Gilliam, tell you what, we'll give you the money for Brazil, but can you do an adventure movie for us first, like Time Bandits? That's what we want.
Yeah.
I mean, and then, you know, but they never do that.
There's something to be said in the 1980s in particular, where movies had to open on lots of screens and they had to make a lot of money back in order to be profitable, for not having the bleak as F ending. Like that one I can, but again, they must have read the script. Why, like, were they planning on changing the ending the whole time and just didn't bother to tell him? Or were they having that battle the whole way through? Like, or were they thinking they might be able to convince him? But that ending alone. But,
to me, and we're both producers, man, the simple logic is, whether it's a 2-hour movie or a 4-hour version, it's still a dark sci-fi movie. It's not, like, at that point, let the film make, let him go. Let him make what he wanted.
Well, but just, I mean, the thing is, but you can focus on the dark. Well, so an instructive example, I think, is 12 Monkeys, which is also a very dark dystopian movie. In almost all ways, a less fun movie than Brazil. You know, Brazil has action adventure moments and car chases and whatever else. And so I can see.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think 12 Monkeys is fun in a creepy kind of, you know, how does time travel?
I'm not saying it's not fun. Yeah. I'm just saying that it's not fun in that you and I have this argument of the semantic difference of the way we use the word fun. I'm just talking about like fun in terms of like a mainstream audience could go to this and munch popcorn and enjoy it. On the page, the elements of Brazil feel more suited to that than 12 Monkeys, which is a movie that, you know, by you can't change the ending of, because the ending, because that's the whole story. It doesn't have the sense of whimsy that Brazil does.
No, that's true. It is much darker.
But that movie did a lot better than Brazil did. I mean, I think it's a vastly better movie, in my opinion, and that might be part of it.
Well, you got Bruce Willis and young Brad Pitt versus, like, no offense, he's a brilliant actor, but nobody was beating down doors for Jonathan Pryce in 1985.
No. And right. And, but again, I think the story for 12 Monkeys and Time Bandits is much more accessible. It's much, you know, like there is a story. That's one of my biggest criticisms about Brazil, and one of the reasons why I've never sort of revisited it. I think I said this to you the other night. I think that every scene in it is brilliant, and yet all of the scenes together don't do much for me, because there's nothing to hang my hat on. I don't really care about his character, and it does, both of these movies do what I tend to not like about absurdism, which is it becomes very difficult to care about a story when you don't understand the rules of the world, when there essentially are no rules in the world. Like, there's so much stuff in this movie that is just meant as a gag, like the thing with the desk. Mm-hmm. You know, there are so many things that are just gags that are just sort of meant to be funny.
No, I think what you're getting at is I've always been a student of like the different types of comedy. And I think what you're getting at is when you have like this level of farce and it's dark and it's broad, they stop feeling like human characters and they start feeling like caricatures in a political cartoon.
That's fine too. Again, it's the
But then you don't really, like, they could be funny and dark and trenchant and clever, but rarely would you shed a tear for a character in a political cartoon.
You say that. Well, yeah, as a counterpoint to that, I think that Baron Munchausen is every bit as silly and farcical and absurdist, and yet I care very deeply about the characters in that movie.
Yeah, so there's some warmth in that one.
I think it's absolutely possible to do those things. I'm talking more just about sort of like the logic of the world and the rules of the world. And this is the thing we've talked about a little bit on the podcast before about science fiction and how, like, you know, good science fiction, and it's arguable whether this is even sort of science fiction in the sense
it absolutely
that I'm using
is
it right now. In the sense that I'm using the word right now specifically, yep. Which is that you know there's a world and that world has rules and you establish those rules and you stick to those rules because, you know, and you know, as it's as much like our world as it can be, especially if it's supposed to be set in our world. But like, you know, if there's magic, there's magic, and you believe that there's magic. But like, if you spend 3/4 of your story and there's no magic, and then all of a sudden there's magic, like, that's a problem. And in this movie, I didn't, and again, in both of these movies, it's true in Southland Tales too, I don't understand what the rules of the world are because they feel like it's whatever would be the funniest thing at that particular moment in time.
Right. It feels like a comedy, like several sketches.
Yeah.
It's all, you know, yeah. Like there are brilliant moments and set pieces, but without that tent over top that kind of like carries you along, character to plot point, to boy, to girl, to do they get together? Do I care?
For instance, there's this whole running gag through the movie about his plumbing and people coming in to fix his plumbing. And Robert De Niro comes in and these other guys, I think it's plumbing, right? This, whatever it is, this, you know, they tear apart his walls and there's all these pipes and whatever else. And there's no, and again, it's supposed to be absurdism. So I get it on that level. But at the same time, it's like, okay, well, I don't know what level to care about this stuff because I don't understand what the consequences are of this going wrong or going right, or you know, there's this vague sense of him being pursued by people and he's going to get captured by the state, but it's not at all clear what that means. I don't know. It's just, it's an enjoyable movie. It's just, it's hard to watch the whole thing and feel like there's something pulling you through it. You know what I mean?
Nope. I agree. It kind of starts to feel like several days in the life of a ostensibly likable everyman. Although this time around, I'm wondering how much I actually like him. Mm-hmm. And how his bleak, monotonous world of bureaucracy and paperwork is interrupted by the arrival of a beautiful woman who he thinks represents the freedom of dreams and fancy and liberation from this red tape world. And then there's also this subplot, or the might even be the main plot, about how a bug, the chain reaction of a bug landing in a typewriter leads to the wrong man being incarcerated and killed, and how that just leads on a whole labyrinthine domino effect that is clever, but does it feel like anything as a story?
I mean, feels like a Monty Python sketch. So one of the things that jumped out at me as you're talking about that is that this fits in with several themes that we've, a theme that we have covered on more than one episode here of the specifically on the Minority Report versus Logan's Run, about the guy who is a cog in the system who realizes that the system is corrupt when it comes after him.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's such a staple in dystopian fiction in general.
It's also a great noir trope.
Yeah.
It's like the guy in over his head, or the guy, part of the machine who suddenly springs a leak and everybody has to get him out. I love it, but it is very, it's very prevalent.
I could also honestly do without, one of the things that to me constantly stops the narrative flow of the movie cold, what little there is those dream sequences, which as nice looking as they are, they just, they don't
less
add anything.
Less is more, man.
They
don't like, less is more. And you could sense, as much as I do respect him as an off-kilter storyteller, you could sense that in those dream sequences, dude's just in love with his own visuals. Yeah. It's like, man, come on.
They're not moving the story forward at all.
Yeah. And yeah, well, we spent so much time to build this suit and get him up flying. And dude, it's still masturbatory. That stuff is masturbatory. It is.
Yeah.
It's for the filmmaker. We get the point. Yeah. A dream sequence, unless you are imparting something specific, a dream sequence doesn't need to be longer than 25 seconds.
Dream sequences as a whole are almost entirely unnecessary in movies, I've found. But if you're going to have them, they have to say something. They have to say something that a regular scene doesn't say, and they have to.
These say, but Steven, these say he's obsessed.
I get that, but we get that from the movies. My point is, like, they literally are just going over territory that we already understand from the real world. So, like, It just doesn't add anything. I don't know.
I will say that, you know, again, like I said, it kind of holds up to me as a needlepoint of several very smart, insightful, to use another great word I love, trenchant observations about where we are headed and where we are now. I mean, there's the terrorism that takes place, and people are very laissez-faire about it. And, you know, it's pretty prescient in some ways, even though this time around I might not have loved it as much as a narrative. I'm still equally as impressed by Jonathan Pryce, Catherine Hellman.
Catherine Hellman. Score. Can we talk about her for real quick?
Yeah. It's the score is great. The visual scope, even if the movie was just like much more avant-garde and even more obtuse about its plot, it would still be worth seeing for a lot of the visuals, the landscapes and the office buildings and the interiors. Yeah. Gorgeous, weirdly gorgeous.
I mean, you literally could use that description for almost any Terry Gilliam movie. And his best movies are ones where that stuff works in service of the narrative. And his worst ones are ones where that stuff is a substitute for narrative.
Or it starts to overshadow the plot or the character.
Right. Catherine Hellman. I only knew her as the mother from Who's the Boss? She is perfectly cast in this movie. She is always so delightful.
She was the best. She was great. Always just that kind of snooty mid-Atlantic accent, but then she could drop it and be very warm and accessible. And she's just – I mean, I don't even know if we could – what is the thought process behind the plastic surgery, which is some amazing effects,
by the way. Yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorite subplots in this whole movie.
Is that just an observation on how we're just so obsessed with the latest trend, no matter how ridiculous or silly it is?
I would imagine, especially in the early 80s when this movie was forming, that was still a relatively new – obviously, we'd had plastic surgery for a while then, but I remember back in the late 80s, early 90s, when you first started having breast implants being a ubiquitous thing and talking about facelifts and whatever else, it's very much just it was in the zeitgeist at the time, I think, that people were starting to get obsessed with appearances and using surgery to correct them at a level that hadn't existed prior to that era.
I agree. And I also think that it is just larger than that. It is simply Gilliam mocking conformity. That's all.
Yeah.
It is also, like you said, I mean, he could, like, to me, that is also a kind of a knock on the what was very prevalent in the 70s and early 80s were these weirdo self-help groups.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just like constantly leaning on this weird new structure. Yeah.
Well, and I like how, you know, he's got the dual, you know, the mother ends up gorgeous and radiant and the friend ends up this like hideous troll. I loved the commentary on fashion, like the hat with the shoe growing out of it and the absurdity of modern fashion, which again, I think was, you know, in that era, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s was when in all art forms, including fashion, things just kind of went off the rails. It was like, all right, there's no rules anymore. Slap something down on a canvas. That's a painting.
Yep. Throw in some more love. We got Ian Holm, the great Ian Holm, as Sam's boss, Bob Hoskins as the guy who he's De Niro's right hand, right? Isn't he the other?
No, he's engineer? He's the evil engineer, isn't he?
Right. He's his opposition. Correct. And my favorite Python playing maybe the monster of the movie, Michael Palin, is phenomenal in this.
Way against type.
I mean, the fun part is for the first hour or so, he seems like typical Michael Palin, who might have a dark edge. And then once the shoe drops, you're like, oh God, what a perfect, what perfect casting against type. He's great.
Well, and it works because he's not scary. I think that is the point, right? I think the point is, you know, it's very easy to populate a movie with obvious Nazis and be like, oh, they're evil, scenery chewing bad guys. And, you know, I think there is a commentary there by casting Michael Palin and writing that part that way, a comment on the banality of evil and how this whole, he's part of the machine, but at the same time, he relishes what he gets to do.
Right, because if fascism really was, God forbid, taking over your neighborhood, he would be one of your friends who smiles at you on Thursday and chases you down an alley on Friday.
Yep. Turns you into the authorities or whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would say that, you know, throughout my teenage years, and I think this is true of every movie nerd, when you first start to discover that films work on more than one level, it doesn't matter whether you're 75 years old and you grew up, you know, seeing movies well before me. It doesn't matter what era of movies they are. Yep. A lot of movies work on more than one just sitcom or horror movie. Some movies are very, very surface level, and we love them. And other movies have various layers. And what happens is we see them when we're young, and they teach us things about cinema. And then we get to be very defensive of those movies mm-hmm. for a while. Yep. And then we get a little older, and then we go, you know what? Maybe even though the film did teach me a lot, maybe it's okay if people are, you know, don't love Brazil as much as I do, or don't love A Clockwork Orange as much as I insisted that it was a masterpiece when I was 19.
Yeah. I keep coming back to this Putney Swope comparison.
Yeah.
I just like that movie.
That
movie influenced a whole lot of people that I respect. I remember hearing about it the first time, like in that weird Bader-Meinhof effect where like I heard about it the first time and then suddenly heard about it again like in the next couple of days. I heard about it as a reference that Paul Thomas Anderson made about something or other, about how big of a – I think it was because Buck Swope in Boogie Nights is named after Putney Swope. And I was reading an interview with him where he talked about how influential that movie was on him. And then a short time later Louis C.K. was talking about it, and obviously, God rest his soul – It informed his absurdist sense of humor, and so I went and I watched the movie, and it's a Robert Downey Sr. movie actually, mm-hmm. and it's really good and really weird and very absurdist and very almost European.
It's a satire about the advertising world. I haven't seen it since I was in college,
but it has that same sort of feel of like it's Saturday, like that 5 minutes in the future kind of feel, and that. Just that absurd, you know, satirizing of the business world, but through just pure absurdism, through, you know, stuff that obviously can't really happen. That's just funny for funny's sake. I don't know if tonally it's very, very similar to me.
So, Stephen, what would you give Brazil to somebody who has never seen it on a 5-star scale? What would you say?
We do letter grades around here, Scott. Okay.
All right, fine.
It's a B+ for me. It's not a movie that I like love or return to very often. Like I said, every individual scene is like an A, and then the whole thing as a whole put together is probably B+.
Oh, that's a great way to put it. You've written 40 really interesting paragraphs, but none of them really cohere to a story that I care that much about.
Except for the dream sequence paragraphs, but the rest of them are all solid.
And I would also probably, for the longest time, I would have said A, but I think that I've grown into a different person in the intervening years, and I think B+ is fair. I think it is. Sometimes his flourishes yield really fascinating, great stuff, and sometimes his flourishes are indulgent and a little dull. Mm-hmm. And as much as I respect him as a storyteller, you want to just be like, dude, get to it, man. Yeah. Let's go. And another film that I wish would really get to it. This is going to kind of flip it on the other side. We're here to discuss 2006, Richard Kelly's truly, willfully, impressively bizarre Southland Tales.
That's one B word for it.
Yeah.
This movie, all right, so can I just say, this is, you know, when people ask me about this movie or when I have to describe this movie to people, this is the metaphor that I use. So people are familiar with the idea of a movie being, you know, bad and then sort of being so bad it's good. This movie goes past so bad it's good back to being good again temporarily, and then rockets past that to being bad again, and then probably three more times after that. And where it ends, it's like flipping a coin into infinity. Whether it lands on heads or tails for me often depends on what mood I'm in or which time it is I'm watching it. I've probably seen it 4 or 5 times, in the theater originally, and then showing it to people to try to get their opinions. The other probably best description I've ever heard of this movie, our buddy Alan Cerny, rewatched it recently and posted on Twitter that if he had to give it a star rating, he would give it pi divided by zero.
Oh, man.
It just really struck my fancy.
I admire, I respect and admire that film lovers will go to such lengths to both give a film a chance, a second chance, a third chance, and then keep, like, never dismissing it. It's not like a just a junk pile, like, oh, RoboCop 3 is junk and I don't like it and here's why A, B, and C. There's a lot here to unpack.
It's a fascinatingly bad movie. That's the thing. Yes. It's bad. The ways in which it is bad are so unique and interesting that it's watchable because you – okay, so the another thing that I say about this movie is like dollar for dollar, star for star, it's the worst movie ever made. Like there are worse movies, but there are not worse movies that have this level of raw talent attached to them on the screen and somehow manage to make something this bad. Like it's stunning the level of just the sheer amount of talent involved in this movie that couldn't turn a script that was a complete and utter nonsensical mess into anything watchable other than as a fascinating train wreck.
I think every 10 or 20 years around Hollywood, they have to learn the same lesson over again, which is just because your guy made The Deer Hunter, do not give him a blank check to make Heaven's Gate. Just because your guy made Donnie Darko, do not give him a blank check and final cut to make whatever he wants. Because a lot of times you give a filmmaker all the leash they want, they're going to use it.
What's so weird about this is at least Deer Hunter was a hit.
Yeah.
Deer Hunter made money. Donnie Darko did not. Donnie Darko was a bomb. It obviously then developed a...
Well, it was a legitimate cult sensation and made real money when it hit DVD. Not just, people liked it and talked about it, but, you know, it made money, which is why they decided to give him... They were so enamored with the success, the late but still success of Donnie Darko that they said... We're not just going to give you a big budget and let you make what you want. We're going to give you a huge budget and not even look at what you're making.
Well, it's the exact opposite of Brazil, right? We just talked about how studios should do that more. And in this case, they did. And this is probably why they don't do that more.
You and I are both very firmly independent filmmakers. And if we got to move into the studio space, I think it's safe to say that we would trust the producers that were either assigned or we brought, like we would, there's no,
maybe
there's
not.
Look,
no. Okay. If I was given the opportunity to make my dream project, which clearly this was, I would run with it as fast as I could, towards the end zone, and everything else be damned. But the thing about it is that, I mean, you know,
but you'd still have me saying, dude, the studio wants Weird at 70%. Your Weird is at 98%. Can we give them partially?
It's not even about Weird. The thing about this is that it's incompetent filmmaking on almost every level. That's the let's start with the casting. Okay, my description of the casting in this movie is like Richard Kelly like went through and picked his dream cast for and picked the exact right person for every single role in his script, and then
love the cast because it has weird non-traditional people in a major. Big budget, like I really do respect the off-center casting. I do.
It's like he cast everybody that he wanted to in this movie, put them all in the perfect role for themselves because there's a lot of different parts in this movie and there's a lot of different types of characters. And then like as they were going into the script reading, the table read, everybody like crashed into each other and dropped their scripts and accidentally picked up somebody else's. And then they all just played that role instead. Cause you've got like John Lovitz is supposed to be like this dirty cop and he does not work in the slightest bit. You've got The Rock as this sort of nervous guy who's supposed to be like literally every single role in this entire movie. Like I said, talented actors, 100% of them are in the wrong role in the movie. 100% of them. Sherry O'Terry as like the revolutionary leader person. Like he's got these comedy actors, which sometimes that works. Sometimes you pass comedy actors in serious roles and you get interesting things. It doesn't work in literally every single role in this entire movie with the possible exception of Justin Timberlake, who's really given it his all, is miscast. Just miscast across the board in hilariously, spectacularly wrong ways. The John Lovitz. Holy moly, John Lovitz trying to be an intimidating, dirty, murderous police officer is one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my entire life. It's just astounding.
What's interesting is this was just a few years before your arrival, I believe, but this played at Fantastic Fest and everybody was excited. And you know as well as I do that when you get caught up in the film festival vibe, a 3-star movie can go up to 4 and a 4-star movie can go up to 5 because it's just the general vibe of being at an event where everyone's happy and I like that movie and then like turns into love, or it could go the other way where it was kind of okay and then by like 6 hours later, I hated it. You know, there's kind of this little extra burst to your opinions at a film festival.
Yeah.
And people left this movie with question marks over their head.
No, I know. I did too.
Not hating it, kind of just dipping their toe into discussions like, what did we just watch?
What was that? What was that?
And I don't enjoy saying,
yeah,
I straight up do not like it. I straight up think it's mostly indulgent, meaningless, artsy-fartsy, what my old friend Eric Childress used to call film school masturbation.
Oh, it is, 100%. I don't think there's any position that's any defensible position where that's not your conclusion.
You might find it an interesting failure where I had to watch it in 2 sittings and I had real trouble getting through it.
I feel like this whole, I mean, like, I feel like he took whatever his instinct was or whatever, you know, he thought a good filmmaker would do at any given moment and almost always chose the opposite. And I think it feels like it was a deliberate strategy that never worked. Because like even stuff like, you know, in terms of like the casting, in terms of Moby's music, which if you listen to any little piece of the music's not bad. It's Moby. It's good. It's very of its era in some ways, but it's
doesn't belong in this movie.
In every single scene, it's the wrong. It's like, again, it's like he took
incongruous.
It's like he took the music that was written for a different scene and then accidentally put it in. And like, if you could take every piece of music and stick it back in the right scene, like you could take every actor and stick them back in the right role, you could have a good movie. But every single piece of music is in the wrong scene.
Yeah, no, or you could go back in time and go, all right, Rock, you were supposed to have his pages, and Sarah Michelle Gellar, you're supposed to have Bai Ling's pages. And, you know, like Justin Timberlake, John Larroquette.
I mean, none of that, of course, is going to say, should we even talk about the plot such as it is?
It's labyrinthine and multi-threaded.
It's also apparently the second 3 parts of a 6-part
story. Yeah, they gave us the comic books at Fantastic Fest, and they're as dense, and I don't mean in a bad way, but
they don't make it make any more sense.
And you also, I also a lot of times have to remind myself, there are people who really like movies that are 75% plot and the rest is just you have to fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
That's not really my vibe, but just because I don't like it doesn't mean it's not legitimate.
Well, the plot of this, the storytelling is so epically bad that it made me like Donnie Darko less. Like Donnie Darko is the kind of movie that I watched and I was like, I don't entirely get everything that's going on, but I feel like the filmmaker knows what's going on, and I'm along for the ride because there's so much good stuff happening in here that even though it doesn't all quite hang together at the end, I feel like I'm in good hands. And then I watched this movie and I was like, no, I was not in good hands. And then, you know, then the box that came out afterward, and I was like, oh, okay, no, he just doesn't know how to tell a story.
I don't like that movie.
So it retroacted this movie that is so bad. It's like a black hole of badness that it made his previous movie. It like went back in time and made his previous movie worse.
Oh, I don't agree. I think the theatrical cut of Donnie Darko is still great. It is definitely of its era. But I love. I think there's a lot of smart, fun, creepy ideas in the.
Every character name is terrible. Boxer Santeros, Fortunio, like every line.
It almost, you know what? You describing the movie. Everybody knows the sophomore slump. It's like if somebody makes either a financially, critically, or audience successful movie, their second film will be some kind of untoward, unmitigated disaster. And it's almost like he realized that and went, you know what? I'm just going to steer into the sophomore slump. And
I think he got to make his dream project and he's like, I'm going to do it no matter what.
I just don't get that this would be your dream project.
He started writing this apparently like in high school and that shows.
My dream project is a monster on a space station. Like that's like what? That's easy. Well, but what is this?
Kind of dream project that like.
I don't get it.
By dream project, I mean the kind of movie that you never think that you were going to get the opportunity to make. The one that's like, you know.
For good reason.
Well, exactly. But so again, if you have the opportunity to make this weird, personal, idiosyncratic thing that where you get carte blanche, like you're gonna go, like I would take that opportunity, and if the movie turned out terrible, then you know, I would hope that it wouldn't, because but I don't know. Anyway, I think you could literally, the funny thing is that there's a scene in Donnie Darko very early on. There's a scene with the family at around the dinner table. It's one of the first scenes in the movie. And it's a brilliant masterclass in how to introduce characters and get exposition out in a short period of time. It's just a dialogue scene, but it's one of those things that I would show to screenwriting students as a well-written scene. This movie, I swear to God, you could literally take any random line from this movie and A, it's a terrible line, and B, it's the worst possible line reading of that terrible line, like across the board.
There's a lot of weird choices in editorial in this movie, and I know exactly what you mean. And it's like, why would you either ask your actor to deliver it or not ask them to do it again?
Right.
When you,
yeah, so much. Again, this is what I love about this movie. And again, it's not a movie that I just sit there and like watch over and over again. It's baffling. It's baffling in a way that I find fascinating to revisit. It is different, and I didn't make it all the way through this last time, to be completely honest. I didn't finish watching it. In fact, the reason why we set this episode up like 6 months ago, I think, at this point, but then never got around to recording it, is because I never watched the second half of this movie. And I'd seen it enough times that I didn't really feel like I needed to. But it's not an easy movie to watch, for sure.
You know what Richard Kelly's favorite movie is?
Putney Swope.
Brazil.
Is it really?
Yep.
Are you making that up, or are you saying
no,
that?
No, it's true.
Okay, so
it's
I was right to pair these two together. This is very clearly meant to be his Brazil, except that Terry Gilliam is a talented filmmaker and Richard Kelly is not.
Here's what I'm from his Wikipedia page. Richard Kelly said this about Brazil. I think the greatest thing I learned from Terry Gilliam is that every frame is worthy of attention to detail. Every frame is worthy of being frozen in time and then thrown on a wall like an oil painting. And if you work hard on every frame, the meaning of your film becomes deeper, more enhanced.
And this is the movie that he made? Because it's ugly, too. That's the thing. Yeah. Is it's not even a, you know.
Right, but I mean, that could mean a lot of things. What does that mean? Getting that right vintage soda bottle in the right corner of your frame, Rich? Is that what it means?
It's just, production design-wise, cinematography-wise, there's nothing about this movie that's worth that quote.
It's all bleached out and ugly. It looks like fisheye lenses and sweaty people. That's what it looks like.
All right. So insofar as there's any science in this movie, I don't even know how to discuss it.
The science of Justin Timberlake being a magnetic. How is it that one man could be so magnetic?
He's the only thing worth watching in this movie. But at the same time,
that the musical number in the middle of the movie makes me desperately wish that the movie had removed some of the worst scenes and put in four or five more musical numbers. Because what happens now is you have this, you know, visually at least somewhat interesting or unique or different or offbeat world in a visual sense. And I don't want to hear these dim bulbs talking about a plot I can't follow. So at least in 6 or 7 scenes, put a song in there and I can appreciate it in a more abstract way.
Well, so the plot such as it is, it's about the guy, The Rock, who gets his memory wiped somehow and dropped off in the middle of the desert. That's all apparently covered in the prequels. Apparently there's some company, like they're building a perpetual motion machine that can take energy out of the ocean, and the energy companies don't like that, which is why they kidnap him, and he's married to a senator's daughter or something. So they try to get him with a porn star to have some sort of a scandal, but then that never really goes anywhere. And then the most baffling of all is Sean William Scott, Stifler, who plays a police officer who apparently also has what you think is a twin brother, but then by the end of the movie you realize maybe it's a double of him that he somehow got copied. And the whole movie has been them trying to keep them separate because if they touch each other, it'll explode the whole universe. None of it makes the single lick of sense on a narrative level, let alone obviously a scientific
one. No, but then you, like I said, then like Brazil, then you start to look at it on an allegorical level. And it doesn't hold up there either. Brazil, at least to me, holds up as a cautionary tale of, hey, we're becoming drones and slaves to a machine.
Well, the
I
other
don't
thing
get
is
any
the,
kind of message to like that from
the era that this came out in too. And so this movie, really, again, I walked into it with very high expectations. I had not heard all of this stuff about Fantastic Fest. I saw it in the theater when it actually was released. And, you know, I was a huge fan of Donnie Darko, and so I was really excited about this. I knew nothing about it, and I walked in there, and the opening scene is like kind of like this found footage opening. You know, it's supposed to be like a somebody's, you know, backyard
home movies,
barbecue, yeah, or whatever, home movie, and a nuclear bomb goes off, and they're, in Abilene, Texas. And it's very real and very convincing and very shocking, and you know, coming as it did in 2006, which was sort of at the height of the war on terror, and these fears of weapons of mass destruction and whatnot, you get the sense throughout the entire movie that he's trying to say something about that and the Bush era and politics I've seen this movie 4 or 5 times. I couldn't tell you thing one about what he's trying to say at all.
Yep.
So you're right. It doesn't work on an allegorical level either. It's just, whew.
I will say, though, that I like The Box more than you do. It's based on a Richard Matheson story, and it's a simple thriller. Not great, but I think it's better than its reputation. And he has not directed a film. He has not directed a film since 2009.
I wouldn't let him anywhere near a camera if I were in charge.
I wouldn't hand him this much money, but yeah. I would definitely make a film with Richard Kelly.
I think he's doing commercials and stuff again, commercials and music videos and whatever.
According to Wikipedia, he is working, writing and directing a Rod Serling biopic, which I would be very interested to see.
Again, he's one of those filmmakers. There are a handful of guys who made one movie that was good enough that they can make a whole string of terrible ones, and all, like Rob Zombie's another one. The Devil's Rejects is a good enough movie that even though almost everything else he's made is complete garbage, I'll still go see all of his movies in the hope that maybe he might one day repeat that feat. And Richard Kelly's the same way.
Right, but he's only doing, he made, you'll admit that, maybe not financially, but Donnie Darko is an impactful, reputable film. Then he did this, which, you know, bombed. And then he got to direct The Box, which is obviously a much smaller budget. But why has he not directed anything since then? Come on.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he just hasn't had a project that some, you know, I get the sense his ambitions are such that he wants to make something that's bigger than he can probably raise a budget for. But maybe not. I don't know.
So as weird, slightly futuristic satires about modern culture, Brazil, Southland Tales, good double feature or bad?
I would, no, it's a terrible double feature just because they're both movies that are hard to get through. They're both movies that are just because neither one of them has a plot, you know, sitting, and they're both really long. And so 5 hours of plotless meandering is not something I would wish on anybody.
I don't enjoy saying it, but I think that for sheer audacity, it holds some novelty value, but that really starts to wear off after a while. So I would give this movie like D+, C- on a good day. I just do not like it.
Yeah.
I always respect weirdness and ambition, but man, it's got to be in service of something more interesting than just that.
I'm going to just go with Alan's rating, pi divided by zero. I think that it is a fascinating mess of a movie. It exists outside the spectrum of good or bad. It's like a Nietzsche movie. It's beyond good and evil.
I would like to live outside that spectrum.
It's a fascinating movie to show other people. That's one of the main reasons why I've seen it as many times as I have, is because it's a movie that just sitting there, because, you know, like you said, your experience at Fantastic Fest, like it's fun to show this movie to somebody who's never seen it before and then like literally just see the question mark over their head afterward and then have a discussion about it.
Yeah.
And just introducing to somebody that experience for the first time. I can totally understand why nobody would ever want to see this a second time, but it's absolutely a movie I would recommend for people to watch a first time because it's fascinating. Just on every level.
With a joint.
Yeah. It's amazing to behold.
Yeah, well, thank you all for entertaining our non-traditional episode of Science versus Fiction. These are two sci-fi movies. They don't dabble all that much in science, except I don't think plastic surgery could ever work that way. But next episode, we're going to be back with something monstrous, as in monsters are in it.
Lots and lots of monsters.
So thanks for listening.
Thank you, guys, and we'll see you soon.